for June 20th, 2009. This is the Law is Cool podcast. On today's show, I speak with Michael Litchfield of the BC branch of the Canadian Bar Association about the Rural Education and Access to Lawyers Initiative. This program is aimed at ensuring access to legal services in rural BC. But first, part one of Omar Haredi's two-part interview with Jason McLean about corporate social responsibility and the precautionary principle. Now, Jason is an associate in the litigation department with Osler, Hoskin & Harcourt LLP in Toronto. He's also one of the contributors to Corporate Social Responsibility, a Legal Analysis, published by LexisNexis. On today's show, he talks about the business case for CSR, as well as legal developments around disclosure of environmental risks.
So I'm here today with Jason McLean, who's currently with, maybe you can tell us where you're with right now.
I'm an associate at Osler, Hoskin & Harcourt in the litigation group in the Toronto office.
Okay. And Jason, you recently came out with a book called Corporate Social Responsibility, published by LexisNexis. I was hoping you could tell us how you got involved in this book and what exactly your role was in it.
Right. Well, it was when I was just graduating at McGill Faculty of Law back in 2006, and my professor, Richard Yanda, was just getting this book started. So when I initially signed on, it was just to do research. I was just killing time before I started down in Sherman and Sterling in New York as a litigation associate there. And my initial task was to just draft an outline of a chapter on the precautionary principle.
Okay.
The book is organized around seven CSR principles, and the precautionary principle is one of them. And so I ended up drafting a pretty detailed outline, and then, you know, Professor Yanda, along with Michael Kerr, who's a CSR consultant based in Montreal, and also affiliated, he's lead counsel at the Center for International Sustainable Development Law at McGill.
Okay.
They just asked me to do the whole chapter. Over the next year, I wrote the chapter while I was doing securities litigation down in New York. They liked the chapter enough that they asked me to do another chapter, which is on the accountability principle, and we can talk about that as well. And that's sort of the principle, overarching principle of corporate social responsibility as an evolving legal concept, which is the thesis of the book.
Now, the precautionary principle is becoming increasingly familiar in the general public now because of its relevance to issues like climate change.
Right.
And maybe you can explain to us a little bit behind the legal rationale behind the precautionary principle, and as well as some of its shortcomings as well.
Okay, well, that's great. Basically, I guess as background, the precautionary principle is a customary norm of international environmental law, but it has deep roots in various normative principles, and essentially the idea is first do no harm. It's growing, of course, due to climate change into a more important legal principle, one that's becoming a quasi-hard law principle on the international scene, and one that's going to be increasingly domesticated and incorporated into domestic legal systems throughout the world. And the idea as applied to corporations is that corporations advocating projects that may have adverse, serious, and irreversible environmental impacts should first ensure that safety measures are taken first, and adequate precautionary measures are taken to ensure that those adverse impacts are mitigated. Now, obviously, not everybody is a huge fan of the precautionary principle. In particular, a U.S. legal scholar, and I believe now a member of Obama's administration, Cass Sunstein, has written, I think, at least three books.
Yeah.
Trying to sort of water down the precautionary principle. And I think he's come up with something called an anti-catastrophe principle. Basically, I suppose there are, the weaknesses of the precautionary principle can be summarized as economic weaknesses or economic criticisms, legal criticisms, and scientific criticisms.
Okay.
Let's start with the economic one, because I guess that's the one most relevant and most familiar to corporate commentators, and that's simply that the costs of acting in a precautionary manner are prohibitive.
Okay.
But one of the things that we've learned over the last few years is that's in fact not the case. And it was the Stern Report a few years ago that basically laid out the economic analysis, which I think is pretty well accepted now, that the costs of doing nothing in the long run will be far greater than the cost of taking adequate precautionary measures now. Obviously, politically, there's never a great appetite to incur those short-term costs for the benefit of later generations. But on any kind of rational economic analysis over the medium to the long term, it's clear that taking precautionary measures is the most cost-effective thing to do, just even leaving aside morality, ethics. So in that sense, while there is a short-term cost, no doubt, it is the most effective economic measure. But what we try to argue in the book is we go beyond that.
Uh-huh.
And we argue that the precautionary principle is a form of, it's kind of a catalyst for innovation. By fully taking account the carbon costs of companies' actions without externalizing them into negative externalities and social costs onto the greater public, then companies are, they give themselves the motivation, the incentive to innovate.
Okay.
When you fully price and take into account carbon risk and carbon, the carbon footprint of various corporate activities, in order to mitigate carbon footprint, in order to mitigate negative externalities, companies have to innovate. They have to come up with cleaner solutions. They have to come up with more environmentally friendly solutions, and those solutions will be marketable and they'll be profitable. So companies that take the lead on trying to get out in front of carbon abatement will actually be more competitive in the long run. That's our theory.
Okay.
Some might say that that's fanciful, but I actually don't think so. And I think a number of the leading energy companies, which are probably considered the worst offenders on the scale, are actually doing a lot of research into biofuels and into other areas where they can mitigate their carbon, they can measure their carbon. I mean, that's really the first step in even being precautionary, is being able to actually measure your carbon footprint or your carbon impact.
Yeah.
And companies that do that, and there are a couple that escape my mind at the moment, but that'll be a huge area for venture capitalists over the next few years.
Okay.
Companies that can come up with ways to develop software and various product tracking systems that can measure carbon impact and carbon sort of offshoots throughout the life cycle of various products will profit immeasurably.
So what we saw with the Montreal Protocol as well, is that there were companies that developed CFC alternatives, and they actually profited from that as a result.
That's great. Yeah, that's a great example, and we discussed that in the book, and I think that's exactly right. So far from being, you know, prohibitively costly, we think that the precautionary principle, if embraced, can be a source of competitive advantage.
Wonderful.
Now, legal criticisms. I guess the chief legal criticism, and we don't need to spend too much time on it, is that the precautionary principle is incoherent and vague and doesn't give sufficient precision as to the guidance. So if a company, for example, wanted to embrace the precautionary principle, the question would be, well, what next? What do we do? Does it actually tell us what to do? And as a general principle, it doesn't necessarily tell you what to do on a case-by-case basis. That's true. But at the same time, that's its strength. Because as a general principle, it allows for case-by-case flexibility in terms of its adaptation. Now, a point that Harvard competitive strategy expert Michael Porter made in a recent article in the Harvard Business Review is that there's basically two kinds of CSR. There's sort of window dressing CSR, and there's CSR that's incorporated directly into the core strategies of companies. And it's the latter that we advocate, and by fully figuring out, first of all, okay, as a company, what do we do? And then how can we embrace various CSR principles like the precautionary principle as a part of our strategy, as a part of our unique value proposition and competitive advantage? It's those companies that will come up with precise and meaningful applications of CSR rather than relegating it to sort of the Jack Welch understanding of CSR, which is philanthropy.
Yeah.
So getting back to the precautionary principle, because it's general and because it's flexible, companies that seriously and meaningfully want to embrace it have the flexibility to say, okay, well, this is what we do, and because this is what we do, here's where we can measure our environmental impacts, here's where we can try to mitigate those impacts, And with respect to future projects, we can take a precautionary approach, i.e. look at the potential risks, look at potential harms, and try and figure out, try and innovate ways around them. So in that sense, what some critics have called legal incoherence of the principle is actually a source of its strength.
Because of its flexibility.
Because of its flexibility.
Okay.
Because it's capable or amenable of being adapted to particular circumstances.
Yeah.
It's not a hard black letter rule that you have to try and force fit your strategy into. Rather, it can actually fit your strategy in ways that make sense for a company. So in that sense, companies should embrace it because it's a source of competitive advantage and, of course, increasingly regulatory compliance, and it's what the stakeholders want. So
now, although companies should be doing it, there's going to be companies that don't want to be doing it. So that raises another issue of accountability. How do you hold corporations accountable, and what are some of the statutes that have been passed to try to accomplish this?
Sure. It's a good question, and I think there's basically two drivers or two sources of pressure on companies that will lead the ethical laggards, if you will, into greater compliance. One is obviously hard law statutes. I mean, the precautionary principle has been incorporated by the Supreme Court of Canada into domestic law. So as a legal principle, it's applicable here in Canada. It's also part of the Canadian Environmental Protection Act. So you can find various statutes where it's incorporated and where it's present.
Mm-hmm.
But the greater source, probably, the greater driver of compliance with the precautionary principle comes not from, so to speak, hard law, but from the various stakeholders of corporations. Investors, great example. I mean, you've heard of socially responsible investing, or SRI.
Yep.
Increasingly, investors want to know what companies and what boards of directors are doing to make sure that the companies that they invest in aren't harming the environment. So disclosing environmental impacts and environmental risks to shareholders and to other interested stakeholders as part of sort of that great amorphous concept of civil society, NGOs, not just governments, but NGOs, citizen groups, consumers, citizens, the employees of various companies also. I mean, companies that can legitimately market themselves and hold themselves up to the public as being environmentally friendly will attract people who care about that and want to work for those kinds of companies. So it can be a great source of recruiting talent.
And how can consumers or investors distinguish between the corporations that are just using this as window dressing and those who've actually adopted it as part of their philosophy?
Right. That's a great question because obviously with respect to all environmental measures, you have to be able to distinguish greenwashing from the real deal. And I think that therein also lies another opportunity, both for law and for companies. Now, with respect to law, the Ontario Securities Commission has come out with a staff notice, I believe, about a year and a half ago, demanding greater disclosure of companies' environmental risks. And we're going to see more and more of that. The SEC has been playing around, in the United States, has been playing around with this for a while. And obviously, the EPA is now labeled greenhouse gases a hazardous substance. And, you know, with the Obama administration coming into power, we're going to see greater and greater legal requirements of more disclosure, more meaningful disclosure. That said, regulations in and of themselves are an imperfect source of ethical behavior because companies can still innovate and get around them. The key to meaningful disclosure will come from companies themselves and companies that decide that they want to compete on this basis.
Okay.
Knowing very well that potential employees and consumers and NGOs and other various rating agencies will want real, legitimate, meaningful information will be a driver in and of itself for companies to produce that information. Companies that fail to do it will be those that will end up losing. They'll lose investors, they'll lose the best workers, and they'll lose consumers. So in that sense, the discipline of the marketplace will probably be a greater driver of more meaningful disclosure of environmental risks and, of course, precautionary measures.
And what are the challenges for those corporations that don't comply? There are a few tort actions that are available, and what is the implication of those, and how do they fit into the picture?
Sure. I think one area we're going to see a lot more litigation of in the future in Canada will be environmental actions that are tied to securities lawsuits.
Okay.
Increasingly, shareholders are going to be looking very closely at the disclosures of environmental risks in companies' public statements for misrepresentations. And, you know, because environmental harms and environmental impacts are a very serious, very material risk factor on a public company's balance sheet, to the extent that these risks aren't adequately and meaningfully and fully transparently disclosed, boards of directors and companies are going to find themselves liable under securities laws. So it's not probably the case that we'll have a large growth in environmental law per se, but the concerns on the environment are going to be increasingly incorporated into our securities and our corporate governance law. And I think that's going to be a very strong mechanism for those companies who still insist on, you know, not being as compliant as they should be.
That was part one of a two-part interview with Jason McLean about corporate social responsibility. Now, you'll want to be sure to catch next week's show for part two of that interview. Jason will talk about the impact of the Supreme Court's recent decision in the BCE case and what it means for CSR. He will also talk about his new CSR blog, which you can read at csrlaw.wordpress.com. Well, up next, Michael Litchfield tells us about access to lawyers in rural BC and what the BC branch of the Canadian Bar Association is doing to promote legal careers in smaller communities. So joining us on the line is Michael Litchfield. Michael is the Regional Legal Careers Officer for the BC branch of the Canadian Bar Association. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you, Devin.
So you're here today to talk to us about the Rural Education and Access to Lawyers, or REAL, initiative. Tell us a little bit about that program.
Sure. The Rural Education and Access to Lawyers initiative is a three-year initiative of the Canadian Bar Association that was launched in March of 2009. The initiative is funded by the Law Foundation of British Columbia and is basically a coordinated set of programs that address the current and projected shortage of lawyers practicing in rural communities in British Columbia. And the end goal of the program is to ensure that these communities continue to enjoy access to legal services.
Okay. Now, there are a lot of negative stereotypes, of course, about lawyers, and I'm sure that there are some people who would think, hey, communities without lawyers, that sounds great. Why is it, in your view, important that smaller communities do have access to legal services?
Well, it's funny, we do hear those criticisms sometimes, but when I start to discuss how lawyers affect the commerce in a community and the spirit of the community, people start to change their minds. What we hear about in communities is people who have everyday issues that they require the advice of a lawyer, such as a car accident or a divorce or perhaps they want to start a business or do a will, and because there's very limited access to lawyers in some of these communities, they have trouble doing this. A classic example is a community such as, say, Vanderhoof in the Cariboo region of British Columbia that has, I believe, three lawyers. Now, if somebody is undergoing some matrimonial problems, they may find that some of the only lawyer in town that handles that kind of thing is conflicted out because maybe their partner has gone to them. So there are some real fundamental access to legal services and access to justice issues here.
Okay. And in terms of your strategy for ensuring that there is access to those services, what strategies are you using and how effective have they been?
So there's a number of programs that we are unrolling with the initiative. The first program is funding that's provided for second-year summer students. So this year we've created 11 positions throughout the province and staffed those positions with 11 students. These positions are all over the province. They range from the far north in Fort St. John to the Kootenay region and Trail. To the island. There's a number of positions in the island, Campbell River and Nanaimo. So that's one of our main programs, and the hope there is to give students the experience of practicing in the smaller regions in the hope that they'll stay on to practice. a couple of the other programs that we're running is that we have some financial and promotional support to market regional opportunities. So we're doing a series of information sessions at schools throughout Western Canada just to raise the awareness of students that these opportunities are out there and some of the advantages that are available in smaller centers.
Right.
From a secondary point of view, the initiative is working on raising the profile of the issue in the community. So to your point where people may not recognize why it is that we want to have access to legal services, we're liaising with local media and regional media to raise the profile of the issue and looking to do some data analysis and collection on what exactly the situation is here in terms of demographics. One of the driving factors for the program is the fact that we know we have a high number of lawyers who are aging and will be nearing retirement. Mm. And the question is, do we have the young lawyers that are going to be able to take their place?
Right. And I'm going to school in Winnipeg right now, and I know that there's a lot of the same concerns about some of the smaller communities here in Manitoba as well. In terms of some of your promotional efforts, I know in the legal profession there is, for I think a number of young lawyers and students, a sort of a prestige or status associated with working for that big downtown corporate law firm. What kind of strategies are you using to sort of counteract that attitude and actually make practicing in a smaller community more attractive to young professionals?
Well, we're certainly not trying to directly compete with the downtown law firms. There are a number of people who want to practice in downtown areas, and that's just fine. What the goal of the program is to make students aware of other opportunities and of the benefits of those opportunities. So practicing in a smaller community is very different from practice in a larger urban center, but
right.
There are various advantages that go along with that. One of the main advantages that we see in the smaller areas is mentoring. There is a lot of knowledge in some of the senior practitioners, and they're more than willing to mentor young lawyers. So that's one major advantage. Another major advantage is, as I've mentioned, with the demographic shift occurring, what we're going to have is large opportunities for students to establish practices much earlier than they may be able to do in an urban center.
Right.
I have a classmate, I am an 05 call, and I have a classmate who was just offered partnership in the Okanagan in a firm, in a very prestigious firm. So those kinds of opportunities don't often come up in urban centers.
Right. And so you mentioned that you were able to fill 11 positions already. So it sounds like the response has been quite positive so far.
Yes, we've had a really good response. We've been working very closely with the career development offices from all of the major universities across Canada, and we've had an overwhelming response from both the profession and the students, actually. There's a great recognition within the profession that this type of program that educates students on these opportunities is required. We had a number of firms step up immediately who were interested in taking on students. And from the student side, we had an overwhelming response actually as well. And we're hoping that we're going to continue the momentum into next year. We will be offering this program, as I said, it's a three-year program. So we'll be offering the summer positions again next year and expecting a great response as well.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I know that we do have a lot of listeners who might be studying law at UVic or elsewhere in the province. So how could they get in touch with you or find out more information if they're interested?
Definitely. There's two ways. We do have a website set up, and that is at www.realbc.org. And that has a lot of background information on the program and the initiative. As well, I invite students to contact me directly, and my email address is mlitchfield@bccba.org, and it's also on the website there. I really encourage students to get in contact with me directly. We can, and I can let you know how the programs will be of benefit to the students.
Excellent. Well, thank you again so much for joining us on the program, and best of luck to you with the initiative.
Thank you very much.
That was Michael Litchfield from the Canadian Bar Association BC branch. Well, that's all for today's show, but be sure to tune in next week for part two of our interview with Jason McLean about corporate social responsibility. For the Law is Cool podcast, I'm Devin Johnston.